from the jolly Saint Nick, but I guess we'll have to make do with you. Greetings, Uncle. She cupped a hand to the side of her face, shielding her mouth from Nicholas. He is, she began in a stage whisper. Still my uncle, right? Not my stepbrother twice removed or anything. Nicholas shot Fleur a pained smile.
Yes, Lutine, he said, using his favorite nickname for Lucy. I am still your uncle.
Fleur was both pleased and somewhat surprised to sense Nicholas felt an honest affection for his niece. With Lucy's father 1,000 miles away on the map and 1,000,000 miles away in terms of an emotional connection, Lucy could benefit from a solid relationship with her uncle. Fleur felt a tinge of sadness as she realized how much better Vincent had been suited to playing an avuncular role in Lucy's life.
Thinking of redoing the old pile?
Nicholas began examining the sketches, lifting them one by one and holding them up to the natural light that filtered through the window.
More than thinking. Please don't interfere. Tu m'écoutes, Nico.
She punctuated her plea with a long-abandoned childhood name, an appeal to any small spark of affection that might still glow in his heart. He answered with a nod and returned the sketches to the table.
You'll need to deal with the foundation before tackling,
he waved his hand over the designs,
the cosmetics. There are some substantial cracks.
Nicholas wanted to believe he was so very different from their father, but Fleur could see he still regarded her as Celestin had, as la belle, bécasse, pretty, but empty-headed. The contractor will be starting after the new year, Fleur said. The gentleman who took over Vincent's business, she added, to lay the blame where it belonged, squarely at Nicholas's feet. Due to an inheritance scheme set up almost 2 centuries earlier, ownership of the house fell to the eldest son in each generation. Vincent would have shored the foundation up long ago if Nicholas had let him. But their elder brother had never made a secret of his loathing for the family's historical home. Nicholas had even castigated a stunned Vincent for making necessary repairs after Katrina. After that, he'd refused to allow any upkeep on the structure. Left unloved for more than a decade, it counted as a wonder that the house had fared as well as it did in the New Orleans climate.
I leave it in your capable hands, then, he said,
though his emphasis on the word capable telegraphed that he considered her anything but. He was leaving the restoration to her partially because he thought she'd find herself in over her head.
But you must realize you're only buying time. It's more than the foundation of the house crumbling. It's the land beneath it.
Lucy began. Fleur could tell from her daughter's wrinkled brow that she was spooked.
Is it safe to stay here, or are we going all House of Usher?
We are, Fleur said, with a challenging side glance at her brother. As safe here as anywhere else in southern Louisiana. The Mississippi River is alluvial. The sediment it carries would, if nature were allowed her way, build shifting banks and determine the path of the river's flow. When they fixed the river's course, the engineers created a situation where the water table beneath New Orleans started falling, taking the land lower with it. Unintended consequences are sometimes poetic. She allowed herself one small warning jab at her brother. The very thing that makes it possible to prevent the land from flooding is causing the land to crumble beneath us.
You are so not making me feel better.
And on the other end, Nicholas added, the Atchafalaya is silting up. The next big flood may change the river's course anyway and wipe out a couple of towns along the way as it does.
Fleur could see a spark rise to Lucy's eyes. Kind of like what Alice has been saying about magic.
You've been speaking to Alice? About magic?
Fleur had been encouraging Lucy to spend time with her cousin, but she had assumed Lucy would encourage Alice to develop a healthy respect for consumerism. Not that Alice would enlighten Lucy about the occult, perhaps more than was safe. Her daughter had an uncanny ability to pick up on subtle clues, at least when she wasn't practicing a willing obliviousness.
Is that so unexpected? She knows things. And it isn't like we have oodles of other interests in common.
It's good you are, it's only... Well, never mind. What did Alice tell you?
That magic is meant to be wild and untamed. That it's something you can tap into, but never control. At least not forever. Maybe magic isn't dying. Maybe its course is silting up.
Nicholas regarded his niece with surprise, as if he'd encountered a donkey quoting Shakespeare.
What?
Lucy said, picking up on his incredulity.
Nothing, he said,
coming alert, a spark of pride rising to his eyes.
Nothing at all. It's only I'm happy to see you taking an interest, at long last.
Behind her daughter's back, Fleur arched her eyebrows at him and gave a quick shake of her head. As Lucy turned toward her, she managed to cover the expression by brushing back her bangs.
Perhaps I would have a long time ago if I were really a part of the family, Lucy began.
Well, you know what I mean. If I were like the rest of you.
You are a part of this family, Nicholas said. Though at times it seems you're the only one who wants to be.
His lips curled up into something that resembled a conciliatory smile.
Listen, he said, shifting his focus back to Fleur. I wanted to stop by and let you know in person that I'm back. We have a lot to talk about, but at the moment I'm a bit pressed. You see, I have an event I'd like your help with, and the clock is ticking. This was not a request. It was a command.
What kind of event?
Fleur could feel herself beginning the smooth shift into the guise of politician's wife. She had been groomed, if not born, to stand at the side of a powerful man, doing his best to win over other powerful men.
I'm hoping you'll join me. Well, actually, I'm hoping all of the region's remaining witches will join me. In reviving a lapsed tradition.
His face brightened as he reached into his coat pocket and retrieved what appeared to be a bit of glossy cardstock. He gave it a quick glance, then held it out to her. She took it, expecting an invitation, but instead she found herself holding an old Polaroid photograph from the late 70s of the three Marin children, Nicholas, Vincent, and herself. In costume.
Oh, Nicholas, Fleur said, her own delight surprising her. The longest night?
She stared down at the picture, trying to make a connection between the girl dressed as a tiny Morgan Le Fay and herself. With Nicholas, it came with greater ease. He was older than she, and in the photo had already begun to display many of the traits he was to carry into adulthood. Young Nicholas's costume consisted of a red bodysuit with a pointed tail, a headband with horns, and a black trident. His hand rested on her shoulder. Vincent stood beside them, though at more of a distance, as if he, like Lucy, felt he wasn't really a part of the magic. He was dressed in a black suit and held a leather-bound journal in one hand, and an oversized quill in the other. Fleur didn't remember seeing him in the costume, but she recognized it as the dark man with his book of damned souls. Lucy crept up beside her and took Fleur's hand.
Cute, she said, taking the photograph from her. Halloween?
Not Halloween, Fleur said.
but close. It's Witches' Halloween, the real one, the winter solstice. It's the longest night of the year, hence the longest night. She looked up at Nicholas and added, Tomorrow night.
Non-witches used to bar their shutters from dusk till dawn, he said. Of course, the night became watered down over the ages until it lost its significance.
Like Halloween, Lucy said. The other real one.
We used to call it La Défile des Maléfiques, Nicholas continued, ignoring Lucy's quip. Because it's the night where we embrace the image of evil projected onto us.
My, how terribly liberating.
No, Fleur fought against her daughter's propensity to make snap final judgments. I know it may sound silly, but it truly is a marvelous sight.
Une procession en flambeau.
A torchlit procession.
Once we used actual torches, Nicholas added,
at the worst possible moment, if he wanted to convince Lucy the event could have any cool factor.
Though as far back as I can remember, it's been a few candles mixed in with flashlights. Safer for everyone considering the shaky grips and unsteady walks of some of our fellows.
The longest night, Fleur offered. Always used to bring the covens together.
That is precisely my goal.
His look seemed to telegraph a thought to Fleur. Her heart leaped as she realized this somehow fit into a plan to help Lucy. A devil's grin flashed on his lips in the moment before his face smoothed into the mask of a beatific angel.
I hope to bring those of us left together. Build a new coven out of the ashes.
Fleur doubted her brother would get much further than she had, but for all Nicholas's faults, he was an excellent leader. If anyone could find a way to resurrect a sense of commonality in the fractured community, it was her brother. Even so, his efforts seemed to be too little too late. The witching community had been teetering along the line between moribund and extinct, even before the slaughter. Most of the witches left had been too old or antisocial to attend Celestin's memorial ball.
Our elders will appreciate the nostalgia of the event, Nicholas said, as if he could glean her thoughts at will. Especially the burning of a wicker man. And our friends who prefer a solitary path will, I hope, enjoy the anonymity of the event, as well as their ability to slip away once they've had their fill of human interaction.
You certainly have my support, Fleur said. A look of amusement rose to his eyes. He found it funny she spoke as if she had a choice.
Then perhaps you and Eli will do the honor of lighting the effigy.
Fleur felt her mouth go dry. Eli has been out of reach for a while now. At least for me.
Oh, I'm sorry. He had mooned over you for so long, I'd assumed that given a second chance.
Listen, Mom.
Lucy jumped in, Fleur felt sure, to rescue her. Then paused as if to regroup.
Don't get me wrong. Love the idea of parental condoned mischief. Love, she lingered on the word, it. But about this longest night thing.
Lucy's words drifted off, and she cast a coy glance at the floor. The combination signaled her lack of interest in the affair.
Yes, what about it? The Marins were not exactly well-loved since your dad kind of, well, massacred a lot of people, and by a lot, I mean a lot.
No, Maloutine, we are not.
Maybe we should pass on this parade, or whatever it is.
It is a procession, Fleur corrected Lucy, not a parade.
And the oh-so-significant difference would be...
A parade, Nicholas began, is for the spectators' entertainment. A procession is for the edification of its participants.
Okay, sure. Lucy gave Nicholas her signature eye roll. I am always up for edification, but maybe there's a way more fun and far less opportunity for revengey option to pull the old gang back together.
You don't have to worry about your safety.
Nicholas cast a glance toward the hidden passageway.
Celestin has paid the price. The other's acceptance of his body for use as relics has paid for our pardon.
Ugh, I don't want to think about it. Bits and pieces of Celestin?
Changing hands like currency, and currency is what his body has become.
But he can't feel anything, right? She focused on Floor. You, like, exercised his head, right? So he's... Well, whatever. So he isn't...
Yes, Lucy. We've discussed this.
Floor fixed Nicholas with a perhaps too innocent gaze. I still don't know how Alice...
Don't judge her, dear.
Floor hoped to put Lucy off the subject. Parental judgment usually drove her to change topics or to storm off. Right now, Floor would settle for either. I'm not judging her. Not really. Not much. I mean, part of me is in awe of her, and part of me is terrified. But all the same, I know this longest night fun run is like a holiday tradition.
Oh, it's more than a tradition, Nicholas said. It's a sacred duty.
A sacred duty we've never participated in.
A sacred duty you've never participated in. I've walked the path many times.
I'm guessing like maybe twice since 1982, though, right?
We haven't celebrated longest night since... Floor tried to pinpoint a year. Well, I can't really remember. Since we were children.
She looked to Nicholas for confirmation. Lucy folded her arms across her chest and glared at Floor. I rest my case.
So I've lapsed, Floor said, returning her daughter's deadpan expression. I'm home now, and ready to return to the fold. After all, the Chanticleer Coven used to lead the procession, and we Marins.
Yeah, we led the Chanticleers. Okay, but burning a wicker man? It's like some kind of lame outsider art.
It's a leftover practice from the old days, Floor said. Lore has it when magic was stronger and reality more pliable, witches would turn themselves into will-o'-the-wisps on the longest night. We'd lead a wayfarer astray and burn him as a sacrifice to take the place of the fallen sun god in the underworld.
Charming.
A longest night celebration is more than a bit of local color, you know, Nicholas explained. It was once worldwide. Witches everywhere would venture out, doing their part to return the light to the earth.
Checking in to make sure we're clear on a point, you both understand that this is all metaphor, right? The world is going to wobble back up whether or not a bunch of senile old sorcerers teeter along the river carrying an open flame.
Nicholas raised an eyebrow. Are you so sure of that? He said. Many once considered witches' duty, their only duty, to be the bringers of light. Your grandmother Lore's side of the family had the tradition of naming the firstborn boy and girl of each generation a variant of Luke or Lucille because of it.
Oh, I thought there was some dusty old ancestor lingering on the edge of soon-to-be-forgotten history.
Well, legend has it there once was. Nicholas's mischievous grin resurrected itself. He, too, was a rebel. Like you. Lucy rolled her eyes.
Yeah, more like Luke.
Nicholas rocked back, genuinely stricken. Her face froze.
I'm sorry. I so did not mean to go there. My mouth was in motion, and my brain couldn't shut it down in time.
It took Nicholas a beat to recover. It's all right. Luke was our Phaethon, he said, opting to substitute Apollo's ill-fated son for his better-known and far more Catholic counterpart.
Come on. Frankly, this may be the last year the procession ever takes place. Anywhere.
You'll enjoy it, Fleur coaxed her daughter. It will speak to your taste for the dramatic. The sight of the bonfire at the end is even called the end of the world. I'd like to share the tradition with you. Please?
For me?
Ugh, Lucy said with mock exasperation. Save the maternal guilt. I'll go.
Nicholas applauded, then folded his hands and bowed to them. He drew near and kissed Fleur's cheek.
Wear your flats, ladies, he said, as he exited the room. We'll be walking a distance and crossing over train tracks.
Lucy said, turning to Fleur. Tell you what, I'm in a generous mood, so I'll let you off with new Louis Vuitton sneakers.
She shrugged. Deal. A young man appeared in the doorway.
Excuse me, ladies. The gentleman told me I could come through.
In the crook of his left arm, he carried an enormous and extravagant bouquet of probably 3 dozen roses. In his right hand was a small square cardboard box.
Someone must be feeling guilty, he said, meaning it as a joke.
See? Lucy said, advancing on the poor man as if she were a tiger stalking prey. I told you Eli would come crawling back.
She snatched the card from the large bouquet and tugged the message from its envelope.
Oh, she said, her face falling. They're from Dad.
A sharper shade of disappointment slid across her face.
They're for me.
She let the card drop to the floor and left the room.
Oh, jeez, the delivery man said. I'm sorry, I didn't really think.
It's fine, don't worry. You couldn't have known. Fleur circled around to her work table, then dug beneath some samples for her wallet. She found a 20 and crossed to the delivery man. He was still struggling under the weight of the large bouquet.
Oh, I apologize, she said, still trying to look pleased by the delivery. Please put those down anywhere you find a space.
The man's face telegraphed relief, and he set the larger part of the burden down on a side table.
I think, he said, proffering the box he still held, this one is for you.
Fleur accepted the box, handing over the tip in exchange. Thank you for bringing these. I'm sure the holiday season is very busy for you.
It's my job, he said with a shrug.
Fleur nodded. Do let me show you out.
That's okay, ma'am. I can find my way.
He went to the door, then turned back.
You have a nice Christmas, okay? He said.
You too, Fleur responded, surprised to find a sincere smile rising to her lips.
She waited, listening intently for the sound of the door closing behind him. Only then did she dare read the message accompanying the box. It read,
A bit of magic of my own, for the rarest of flowers. W.
She opened the lid of the box. Inside lay a single camellia flower. A Middle Mists red, exceptionally rare in any season. In December, a near impossibility. An outwardly loving gesture which, in fact, underscored that Warren was now wealthy and influential enough to no longer need the Marins. This was the bastard's way of announcing the divorce was final.
The doorbell rang again. This delivery would be the settlement papers. At least Floor wouldn't have to tip. 10. Evangeline turned her face away as Lincoln leaned in to kiss her goodbye. The Boudreaux had summoned him and Wiley up to Natchitoches to attend an impromptu family meeting or, given the secrecy that seemed to overhang it, cabal. Evangeline focused on Sugar, curled up and sleeping on Lincoln's sweatshirt, which Evangeline had shed like a skin and dropped onto the sofa. When she had pulled the shirt on that morning, its gray fleece and Lincoln's scent had comforted her. Walking home, she had felt suffocated, and she had begun tugging it over her head even as she crossed the threshold. She had gone into the bedroom to dig out the ancient white t-shirt she liked to wear when nothing else seemed to fit, then returned to find Lincoln staring down at his phone. The summons had come by text, which didn't mesh well with the rustic image Evangeline's imagination had conjured of the Boudreaux clan. Lincoln's lips brushed her cheek. "If I had a choice," he said softly in her ear, "I wouldn't go." He had a choice. There was always a choice. But she didn't challenge him. She had lost any right to challenge him. The confrontation with Reverend Bill should have wiped away all thought of Luke Maron, but instead something about the look in the old man's eyes had sharpened the edges of her dream. The sense of Luke insinuated itself a bit deeper into Evangeline's awareness with each passing hour, sticking there, sharp and irritating like burr grass on a tube sock. "You're mad at me." She tried to convince herself it was true. He and Wiley were leaving her short at the club after all, and Lincoln claimed he couldn't tell her what the family meeting was about. But she hadn't turned away in anger. She had turned to her face because of the irrational fear that, even though she'd only dreamed it, Lincoln might taste Luke Maron's kiss lingering on her lips. Another pang of guilt. Now, that made her angry. She shouldn't feel guilty for thinking of Luke, for dreaming of him, for wishing his life hadn't been cut short. Luke had been her first love. Still, Evangeline didn't dare look at Lincoln straight on, afraid he'd realize she was looking through him and at the memory of a man dead going on a decade. "I'm not angry," she said, but she pulled back when he tried to kiss her again. He reached out and caught her chin between his thumb and forefinger, turning her face to him. Irritation rippled across his features, then melted away into hurt. He nodded and sighed. "I'll be back by dinner time tomorrow," he said, releasing her. When she didn't respond, he started to turn away. "Wait," she said, and reached up to run her fingers through his thick mass of blonde cowlicks. She came so close to a confession, but the words got caught in her throat. If she told him he was competing with a dead boyfriend, she doubted he'd take it well. Men were men. His pride would build a wall between them. She needed to sort her emotions out on her own before involving him in them. "Drive careful," she said, and lay her other hand on his chest, a sign of affection and a barrier between them. Evangeline fastened the shutters and locked her Creole cottage's twin front doors. She pushed the living room furniture against the walls and rolled up the area rug, then lit a single white jar candle, her breath still coming heavy from the exertion. She scooped up a protesting Sugar and deposited her in the bedroom, closing the door. The cat hissed, hurling a barrage of expletive images that challenged Evangeline's intelligence, sanity, and scruples equally and at the same time. Sugar couldn't possibly comprehend what Evangeline was doing. Evangeline herself didn't understand. She was acting on instinct. She stopped
as she passed through her kitchen and dug in the junk drawer, until she turned up a piece of chalk abandoned by the young daughter of one of her former dancers. The girl had spent an afternoon with Evangeline once while her mother sorted out some legal or medical difficulty. Evangeline couldn't remember which. Astonishing as it seemed, the little girl she remembered was probably in high school now. Evangeline returned to the living room and knelt in the center of the floor, sketching out, as best she could manage freehand, an old school pentagram. Only then did she allow herself to acknowledge what she was doing. She pushed back from the pentagram and sat with her back against the wall, resting. Sugar launched a fresh volley of recriminations from behind the closed bedroom door. Evangeline blocked out the barbed images framed as dire warnings and pulled her knees into her chest, wrapping her arms around them. She closed her eyes and endeavored to reconstruct a memory she had long tried to erase. Her last conversation, all right, quarrel, with Luke. It had taken place in the small upper-floor apartment on Barracks Street she and Luke had shared after Katrina. He had become obsessed with wrestling control of the Chanticleer coven from Nicholas, and Celestin had encouraged his rebellion at every step. Evangeline could have easily defeated any flesh-and-blood challenge to her relationship with Luke, but she didn't stand a chance against the mania his grandfather was fanning into flame. It was absurd, a ridiculous and wasteful gesture. Even then it had been clear that the once powerful band of witches had fallen into a decline for which there was no hope of reversal. But for Luke, controlling the coven had never been about power. It had been about proving something to Nicholas, about punishing him for driving his mother Astrid away. That day, the day of their last fight, she told Luke that if he went through with the insanity and issued a challenge to Nicholas, a challenge meant to leave one of them victor and the other dead, he shouldn't come back. At the time, she had had no doubt he would be the victor. She'd believed in Luke that much. He was so sure of himself, so full of fire. She'd worried he wouldn't be able to cope with the guilt of killing his father. Luke had laughed at her ultimatum, confident he could oppose his father as the head of the Chanticleers, then win Evangeline back. He'd believed in himself that much, too. Nicholas had surprised them both, twice. He had bested Luke, then offered his hand to him in forgiveness. In a different world, father and son might have one day made their peace, but Celestin had forestalled that happier conclusion by murdering Luke in cold blood. Only Alice had seen him do it. Alice, who had been the first to carve up his corpse at Pré-sur-Saint, though she wished she could have spared Luke's sister that pain, Evangeline couldn't be happier they'd butchered that bastard's corpse, and that he'd been aware of every cut. "I'm sorry," Luke's voice reached her, not triggered by memory but coming to her from the center of the pentagram. These were the words she had wanted to hear most, so it came as no surprise that they should be his first. The Luke in her living room would say what she desired to hear, tell her what she believed to be true. The Luke in her living room wasn't really Luke. She had to fully own that in her heart before she let herself look at him. It was an open secret among witches that most of what went under the cover of necromancy, although it did rely on actual magic, was nonetheless still a fraud. Witches didn't raise the dead. No, Evangeline corrected herself. Witches didn't raise the dead, often. But that hadn't stopped witches throughout the ages from pretending that they did, either for profit or out of sympathy.
A witch could take a mourner's memories and shape them into a simulacrum, a seemingly intelligent, interactive, sometimes even tangible double of the deceased. But the returned was really nothing more than a puppet molded from ectoplasm. Such chicanery was even viewed as benevolent, for it gave the mourner closure, a chance to say the things that in life had gone unsaid, to ask the questions that had gone unasked. This conjuring was known as an indoor spell, named after the biblical story about King Saul's attempt to contact the spirit of the prophet Samuel. According to the canon, the witch panicked when she recognized King Saul, but the true source of her dread was that Samuel's actual spirit materialized. It would have been like fishing in a slow creek with a cane pole and landing a whale.
You haven't changed.
This made her laugh. The thought that her own vanity should float so near the surface. She had been 23 when Luke died, and she had been dragged along a decade's worth of rough road since.
Why did you call me here if you won't talk to me?
It was his voice, all right. The perfect timbre, the perfect rhythm, and a hint of amused arrogance.
You've certainly waited long enough to reach out.
The patronizing irritation in his tone sounded so much like the real Luke that her eyes snapped open.
Ah, there's my girl, he said.
The Luke before her was the 21-year-old she remembered. Only he glowed with his own interior light, brighter and steadier than the candle's flame. I'm not a girl, she said.
I can see that, he said. But are you still mine?
Evangeline hugged her knees tighter in the heavy silence that followed.
I see then. That's what this visit is meant to determine.
He ran a finger down his forearm, seemingly surprised by its solidity. He tried to step outside the pentagram, but the tip of his toe stubbed the air like he had kicked a solid wall. He flashed her a sly, challenging smile that stirred something deep within her, something she'd forgotten or at least buried deeply in her mind. For a moment, she was tempted to cross the boundary and go to him. But then she remembered the man she saw before her only existed in the form of imagination people speak of as memory. Luke was no longer real. But Lincoln was. I've met a man, she said, her mouth going dry. A good man. Who's good to me. And good for me, too.
Then he must not be a Marin, he said, pausing to let the knife he had just plunged into her heart turn. Yes, I know about you and Nicholas.
Of course he would. This Luke could see deeper into her psyche than she could herself, because that's where he came from.
Do you love him, this new beau of yours?
Beau. He might have said lover, or perhaps the ill-fitting word friend, but he had chosen beau, a word that both acknowledged and mocked her relationship to Lincoln. New. She chose to focus on that word instead. It's all new. Too new, maybe. But I think I do. Love him.
Like you thought you loved me?
She bristled. I did love you, but you're gone.
Dead, sweetie. Not gone. No need to parse words.
Of course, that was exactly what she had been doing. The first bitterness that came with an indoor spell was it left you to argue with a candid, all-knowing mirror. She ignored the quip. You've been gone a long time now. And I wasted a lot of that time.
You wasted time mourning me?
I didn't mean that. I meant I wasted it with Nicholas.
Same thing, really. We both know what that was about. Punishment.
Evangeline felt that knife twist again, pushing in deeper. It started that way. I wanted to punish you.
Punish me?
He shook his head and snorted.
That slow train wreck of a tryst you shared with Nicholas was never about punishing me. It was about punishing yourself. And Nicholas, too. Holding him close so that neither of you could ever forget that you'd failed me.
That was a bit more truth than she could handle in this moment. She threw up her hands, ready to send the wraith back into her subconscious. But then he spoke.
What is it you need from me?
She lowered her hands, but she could no longer look at him. I need you to remind me why I loved you, so I can let you go.
Come on, he said, barking out a laugh of disbelief. That's an easy one. I represented everything you felt you weren't. Wealth, privilege, a sense of entitlement. I was the lord of a feast where you always felt like a beggar. I was your prince charming, come to raise you up. Being my girl meant you got to stand in the glow of all that. I deemed you worthy to stand by my side, so you were just as good as anyone else.
Was it? Was I really as mercenary as that? He shook his head.
Of course not. At least not quite. But you needed me to peel away those layers before you could see beneath them. You loved me because you knew I saw that special spark in you. The strength, the smarts, the power everyone else overlooked. And I think I loved you because you reminded me of my mother. Or at least my idealized version of her.
His inky black eyes glowed a bit more brightly.
What a time the two of you might have had. God knows that's really why Celestin and Nicholas wanted me to have nothing to do with you. That's why they tried to demean you by calling you a swamp witch.
Evangeline wasn't sure how to feel about her deeper psyche comparing herself to Astrid Anderson Marin. But that was baggage she'd have to unpack another day. The spark you say you loved. He sees it too. And he loves that I'm powerful not because of what I can do for him, but because of what I can do for myself and others.
But?
But I've begun sabotaging myself. My relationship with...
You can say his name. I know I just spoke of myself as Prince Charming, but this isn't an old fairy tale. I won't use his name to lure him to his doom.
I know I can say his name. It's only when I try to open my heart up to him, completely, you're still in the way.
Then either there's something you miss about me, or something you distrust about him.
The final bitterness of an indoor spell was that once the key truth was spoken, the spell itself was broken, and the mourner was left alone with fresh feelings of loss.
Though I'd like to think, the conjured specter said as he faded away before her, it might be a bit of both.
11.
Papa San has returned.
Hugo stood in Alice's doorway, holding a blue duffel bag over his shoulder. With a tilt of his head, he asked to enter, and Alice stepped aside to let him pass. I know, she said, as he dropped the bag onto her dining table. I tried to call you twice last night, and again this morning, but you didn't answer your phone. He looked back at her.
I have a phone?
That explains why your voice mailbox wasn't set up. I tried texting, too, but...
Daniel, he cut her off with a shrug. Any number you have,
would be for the phone I gave him. He fielded all my calls. Hugo smiled. And occasionally handled the, overflow for me. Okay, that was more information than I would have liked.
I do apologize for offending your delicate sensibilities, he said, placing a hand over his heart. But get over it. Daniel had many facets, and like it or not, one of them was a randy buck. Now, jumping back to the present, your father-brother, his brow furrowed as if he were debating a point within himself. Brother, father? Do we start with a long-accepted relationship or the actual gnarled branch on the family tree?
How about we stick to Nicholas?
Sure thing, Sister Aunt. Nicholas is moving back in, so I need to be moving out.
He looked around the apartment.
Okay if I hang out here for a day? Or 20?
You're always welcome. Alice's apartment was fine for one. It would be tight for two. She knew he'd be more comfortable with Fleur in the Grand Garden District house, but she also knew his request had nothing to do with needing shelter. Her brother, she realized, needed her.
You say that now, he said, already unzipping his bag. But in 3 days, when you're picking up my dirty socks and watching me drink the last of the milk straight from the carton.
How about we don't let it get to that?
Hey, he said. I can try, but some things are out of my control.
He hefted the bag up and dumped its contents onto the table. Glass vials, bottles of pills, plastic bags of powders, and what Alice guessed were dried psilocybin mushrooms and psychedelic herbs. He gave her a mischievous grin.
Brought the whole pharmacy. By the way, I'll need to borrow some socks for you to tidy up.
He winked.
Kidding. My suitcase is in the lobby. Wanted to make sure I was welcome before I lugged it up. By the way, you know they make buildings with elevators now, right?
What's all this for? Alice said, not surprised that Hugo had a large stash of drugs, but disappointed he'd been inconsiderate enough to bring them into her new space.
She had grown up in a psychiatric hospital where medications were forced on you, where clearness of thought was a privilege only granted to the docile. The thought of narcotics for recreational use struck her as inconceivable.
I don't know. What is any of it for?
He reached into the pile, sifting through it until he came upon a small brown glass vial filled with a liquid. He unscrewed the cap, releasing a scent not unlike one of the cleaning fluids used by Sinclair's janitorial staff. He lifted the bottle to his nose, sniffing its contents with each nostril. He shook his head and shuddered, but a wide grin spread across his face.
I started using them to reach altered states to enhance my spells. You get it, right? Launching my rocket where there's less gravity to drag it back down.
His glee was short-lived. His expression turned somber as he recapped the bottle and set it on the table.
Then I started using them to reach altered states, period. Thought all of this might be of some use to you, since you and Evangeline appear to be in the running for last witch standing.
He was right. Alice had always been able to sense the strength of other witches. A remnant of bright sparks still hovered in the ether. The most brilliant Alice herself and Evangeline. But every day a few more lights blinked out. The snuffed lights did not, as far as she could tell, signify deaths or witches taking to the dreaming road. The witches remained alive and present, but their powers had failed them. She turned her focus on the shimmer she knew to represent Hugo, surprised to catch an image of a star swallowing a star. His magic, she realized, was being appropriated by another. By Fleur.
Hugo.
He seemed to read the revelation in her eyes and held up a hand to stop her.
It's okay, he said. It was my idea. A donation given freely and for a good cause.
A good cause?
Lucy. She's dead. Or she should be. But I suspect you already knew that. It's why you granted Fleur the prime cut of Celestin. The thing is, he said, spinning a chair around, then dropping onto its seat. Fleur told me. I can't help but wonder how you found out. Alice hesitated, unsure she should discuss Lucy with him before first talking with Fleur.
I don't know, she finally said. I sensed it. When I focused on her, I could see this weird corona around her, like she didn't quite fit in her skin.
She pulled out the chair opposite him and sat down at the table.
How does it feel to be losing your magic?
Well, doctor, he said, feigning a German accent for some reason. I feel just fracking fine. He leaned in. Really? He said with his normal inflection. I say good riddance.
Alice sensed he meant it.
I mean, magic never brought me anything but grief anyway. He draped his arms over the back of the chair, the same way Nicholas had done the night before. Hugo was, of course, much younger, and his coloring was fair, but otherwise the son was a perfect twin to his father.
So many tiny behaviors learned or innate betrayed one's parentage.
Besides, he continued, I haven't been able to count on it since, well, you know, out on Grunch Road. Shorting out on me without warning. If what little I have left can keep the brat around a while longer, Fleur is welcome to it.
Nicholas said Fleur had to kill to bring Lucy back.
Well, I don't know the details, but resurrection spells, they always require a trade. I figured she must have taken someone out.
And this thought doesn't bother you?
Even desperate, she would have been discerning. I'm sure it was no one nice, and knowing my tati, probably no one attractive either.
Lucy should have been born a witch. That means Fleur would have had to sacrifice another witch. She could be burned for...
Yeah, how terribly malus malfacrum. But who's gonna find out? And how? And even if they did, there aren't enough witches left with big enough balls.
He held up his hands.
Or, not to be sexist, ovaries, to even try to go after her. Her magic may be on the wane, but her money isn't.
Alice bit her lip. She wanted to believe there was no need to worry, but Nicholas's accusations continued to haunt her.
Listen, Hugo said with a sigh. Witches always used to talk a good game, condemning blood magic, but that was all bull. The real reason necromancy was forbidden is because its holy grail is to capture the essence of a great magician, the ultimate relic, and trap it in an alabaster urn or a precious stone like a firefly in a mason jar. No one wants to be that magician.
Alice's mind flashed on the famed diamond of the now extinct Silver Bell Coven. Of course, that was why the stone had been coveted.
But times have changed. Nobody's going to care if Fleur recycled the spark of a witch no one has missed in going on 2 decades to resurrect her child. A lot of witches have been doing a hell of a lot worse for a paltry amount of power. Besides, even if somebody might care, nobody but us knows.
And there it was. Nicholas says the Boudreaux family knows. He says that's why Lincoln and Wiley came to New Orleans.
Hugo's eyes went wide as his jaw dropped.
He tilted his head and looked at her with the confused irritation of a dog hearing a high-pitched noise.
Oh, he said, and nodded.
He leaned back,
as his confusion gave way to anger, his widened eyes narrowing to slits.
This is about Evangeline.
He wagged his finger at her, another gesture he'd picked up from his father.
This is classic Nicholas. If he can infect you with distrust for Lincoln, the virus might start to spread.
He shook his head and puffed out air.
Nicholas doesn't want Evangeline for himself. He doesn't love her. He just doesn't want her to be loved.
There's something else, she said. I told you Astrid claimed Celestin trapped her on the Dreaming Road.
As punishment for not being willing to sacrifice you.
The price required of the heir to the Book of Unwinding. Alice fell silent. She'd clung to this one shred of evidence that Astrid hadn't been a complete monster. She bit her lip. Nicholas says otherwise. He says he put her there to protect us. You, me, and Luke. He says he caught Astrid reading to us from the Lesser Key of Darkness. Nicholas threw the book in the fire, but it wouldn't burn. Hugo's gaze went distant, and a line formed between his brows. He shook his head and focused on Alice.
Sounds like quite the dramatic confrontation, but I don't remember anything like it ever happening.
Then he's lying?
Oh, I didn't say that. It's quite possible it did. It's only I don't remember much from that period. Don't care to, really.
Then it seems we'll never know what happened.
Hugo pushed a path through his mound of illicit pharmaceuticals to find Alice's hand.
Listen, you're wondering which of them is lying, Astrid or Nicholas. Chances are it's both of them, through shading and omission, if not through outright duplicity. You're the artist here. Finding truth in this family is like showing the outline of an object by using the negative space around it. You may never see the truth itself, but you might be able to guess at its shape based on the lies surrounding it.
What do you believe?
I believe, he said, releasing her hand. Some of the far-fetched campfire tales about the final days of magic might not be complete fantasies. I believe it may actually come down to a final witch who will catch magic's dying breath and either bring magic back to the world or preside over its, or rather our, extinction. I believe, my dear sister aunt, that you might end up being that witch. And I believe Nicholas, having arrived at that same conclusion, will say and do anything to slither back from your bad side. Oh, and I believe I'm overcalling you, Sister Aunt. He shrugged. It's been fun, but now it's done.
Well, there's one bit of good news.
I realize now I lied to you about something, he said, strumming his fingers on the tabletop. We had crap for parents.
He leaned forward and clasped his hands together, staring down at them.
Not surprising, since it seems they had crap for parents, too. Astrid was gone. Whether Celestin took her, or Nicholas trapped her, or she merrily deserted us all on her own, she was gone. And Nicholas, it felt like he was never there either. I mean, after Astrid left, I was afraid my hand would pass right through him if I tried to touch him.
His gaze rose and landed on the portrait she had done of Daniel.
But I lied about magic never bringing me happiness. It did once.
Daniel, she said, realizing he had been their only true parent, acting as both mother and father to them.
I miss him. And it hurts like a mother.
He stopped himself. A sad smile rose to his lips. They both knew Daniel had not approved of profanity.
Simple ugly words for simple ugly minds, he'd say,
before marching the offender to a thesaurus to make them find a more precise, less vulgar word. As a little girl, Alice had added the word infernal.